Saving Edmonton, a part of our Heritage Fund. This week, we dig into the provincial budget and how it affects Edmonton. And spoiler alert, it's the same as how every provincial budget affects Edmonton.
Plus, the Cates Group wants to continue its gravel parking lot permit, and the province raves about how successful its homeless reception center has been.
Hi, I'm Troy.
I'm Mac.
And we're
Speaking Municipally.
Welcome back to Speaking Municipally, episode 254.
Troy, we're going to get into the provincial budget, but first of all, how's that electric vehicle tax working out for you?
Well, I actually spent this last week doing my first winter road trip to Jasper. And you know what, Mac? I did not pay a cent in electricity charging. I mean, granted, I did have to, quote unquote, fuel up in Edson, but my car came with a $750 flow credit. So I'm still working my way through that. And there were destination chargers in Jasper. So long story short, I'm living the high life. I haven't yet paid the $200 and I'm still, you know, using all our infrastructure for free.
Oh yeah. Your heavy car just destroyed our highways on your trip, I'm sure.
It's true. As I was passing the tanker truck pulling like a 3-trailer long set of pipes, I was very concerned with my damage to the highway. And I'm hopeful Daniel Smith will let me pay my part. And I just want to take a second to clarify that I do think users should pay for the services they use. I hate that we subsidize all the free parking and all the free roadways when we're riding on transit or riding bicycles. But if we wanted to do something equitable, there should be toll roads that levy fines based on axle weight. I could get behind that. I don't think Daniel Smith or the province could get behind that.
Yeah, you're not opposed to a tax, just an unfair, ridiculously applied one.
Yes, that is that in a nutshell. And if I was to describe InVentures in a nutshell, I would describe it as a breakthrough innovation event that's happening in Calgary from May 29 to 31st. InVentures is going to bring more than 4,000 entrepreneurs, startups, scale-ups, academics, investors, and industry leaders together. And they can cultivate relationships, showcase emerging technologies, and capitalize on Alberta's innovation advantage. Mac, I know you've been to InVentures before.
Yeah, InVentures is a really big tech event in our province. There's all kinds of interesting folks from around the world that attend. It's always funny when you go there because if you're from Edmonton, you notice there's a large Edmonton contingent. And it's like, why did we all drive down the highway just to say hi to one another? But it is an excuse, I suppose, to reconnect with people in the innovation sector. And more than that, I've always been really intrigued by some of the really world-class presenters they bring to the table and the speakers they get from all around the world to talk about really interesting things. You might not always agree with them, but they certainly provide food for thought around where technology is going, where innovation is going. So I've been a fan of attending InVentures. I don't know if I'll be able to make it this year, but if you can make it, you should definitely consider it.
And you can act on that consideration at InVenturesCanada.com. That's InVenturesCanada.com. And that's where you can get your ticket to take in pitch competitions, networking opportunities, and after-hours experiences, plus more. There's more. It's a conference.
All right, we've got a little bit of listener feedback I wanted to address off the top of this episode. So thank you to those of you who wrote in or contacted us and said, wait a minute, is that what you meant? And most of the comments were referring, of course, to the last episode. We were talking about CSU 52. And
can I guess, was it something that I said?
It was something you said, Troy. I don't think anyone takes issue with the comments you made about Lanny Chudik, who's the president of CSU 52. He very clearly did support Mike Nickel and said those things that you said he said. I think what our listeners were just picking up on is that he's the president of the union, but he doesn't necessarily represent the views of all of the members of CSU 52 and speaks on behalf of the union, but perhaps not on behalf of all of those individual members.
For sure.
Which is an interesting little bit of nuance there. I mean, if he's elected by the members, right? Somehow he's still the president. And we'd love to get somebody from CSU 52 on the show to help us understand all of that a little bit better. We've been trying to do that. If you're listening to this and you are that person, please reach out to me. But anyway, just to address that, I don't think we were trying to say CSU 52 as a whole was like Mike Nickel supporters, but certainly the president was.
What I was trying to say, perhaps clumsily, is that I think perhaps administration and council also thinks the same way, that the voice of Lanny Chudik doesn't necessarily represent the views and opinions of all of CSU 52. And maybe that is perhaps why they pursued to have that employer proposal vote, to specifically get around and see, you know, does the union actually speak with one voice on this issue where they may not speak with one voice on others? We are not accusing all CSU 52 members of voting Mike Nickel. That is not something you heard on this podcast. We know you're all Edmontonians. That means you're probably, just statistically speaking, an NDP voter, which is probably a good explanation of why you got pretty shortchanged in this last provincial budget. This came out about a week and a half ago now. We didn't break it down last week as we were waiting for everything to come in and really assess it. And, you know, after taking some time to look at the provincial budget, I can say, Mac, not great for Edmonton.
I mean, it's usual for Edmonton, I suppose you'd say. It's a typical provincial budget in terms of how it affects Edmonton. So, I mean, we won't cover all of the details. You can find out about that lots of places online. But in terms of what it means for Edmonton, the budget includes, of course, some infrastructure investments. So things on Yellowhead Trail, Terwilliger Drive, various bits of funding for LRT projects, funding for McEwen University, which I don't think is new actually, but is recommitted here, funding for NAIT, University of Alberta Hospital, several health clinics. So there's buildings and bridges and roads that are going to get some funding from this provincial budget. It also includes $20 million over 3 years for a new standalone Stollery Children's Hospital, which is interesting, even though the province just before the budget announced that they were going to pause plans for a new South Edmonton hospital. And there's been quite a bit of criticism about that decision because, of course, population toward the south and the south part of the city, which serves surrounding areas as well, is booming. And there's probably demand for a hospital there. The other thing about the Stollery project that's particularly interesting to me is that throughout the month of February, for example, lots of the facility was closed, not because of a lack of funding for a building, but because of staff and physician vacations and a lack of staff, for example. So the shortage of staff caused as many as three different operating rooms every weekday throughout the month to be closed, which is pretty concerning. So I think critics would rather have seen some funding operationally to sort of address that and ensure that those existing emergency rooms can already remain open.
But some might be saying, you know, a new Stollery, a standalone Stollery, that seems like a good thing. It's important to remember that this is $20 million. And if you're thinking, well, we can't build a rec center for $350 million, how are we building a hospital for $20 million? Well, we're not. This $20 million is just advancing the planning funding for the standalone Stollery Hospital. No funds have actually been committed, nor are there any timelines yet for when a standalone Stollery would actually be constructed. But there is some planning dollars being put forth in the budget in lieu of actually building and breaking ground on a South Edmonton hospital. So big win for Edmonton there.
And the Stollery, of course, is a little bit unique. It's obviously a pretty specialized facility. About 40% of the patients come from outside of Edmonton. So it really is a provincial thing. I mean, health is provincial already, but it's even more the case that, you know, by funding the Stollery, the province is supporting more areas of the province and not just the city itself.
Of course, health is one of the big aspects of the provincial budget. Education is the other big one that people talk about. And there was some funding for schools. Edmonton Public and Edmonton Catholic have welcomed a $2.1 billion investment over 3 years for new schools in the 2024 Alberta budget. But after decades of underbuilding, I'm sure this doesn't quite meet the need, nor does it quite meet the timelines, as Edmonton is still slated to basically run out of high school spaces in as little as 3 to 4 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, the funding for schools is great. The problem is those schools don't often get constructed until years after the budget has been announced. And so that's a challenge when you've got, you know, booming enrollment and things like that. The other part of this is similar to what we talked about on health. The Alberta Teachers Association said it's not just schools. We need more teachers and support staff. And there's been years of budget shortfalls. You know, we need to have new schools, but we also need to put staff inside them to operate them and to teach the kids that are going to go to those schools.
Yeah, the Edmonton new schools that are funded in the budget is a 7 to 12 school in Glen Ridding Heights, and the construction of four new Catholic K to 9 schools in Heritage Valley, Cavanaugh, Rundle, Crystallina Nera, and Hayes Ridge. Of course, this budget did address some of the houselessness issues that we've been talking about in the past few weeks, though not quite in the way that we'd expect. Most of the funding was slated towards things like more police officers and more funding for adding shelter spaces and temporary solutions, as well as treatment.
Yeah, apparently the budget will fund 100 new street-level police in Edmonton and Calgary. I don't know exactly how that happens, Troy, given that the police are funded through city council and the police commission, RCMP officers?
Yeah, it's a really good question. The last time this came up, we also didn't get an answer, given that this was one-time funding. How exactly does it fund recurring staff positions? Dunno. Dunno is a good answer to that question.
The Edmonton Coalition on Housing and Homelessness also said it was quite disappointed with the budget, saying that the funding that is in the budget for housing is insufficient and only provides about half of the requested $600 million for the year. And there's also budget cuts, of course, to income support, which will potentially make the crisis even worse in Alberta.
Of course, this comes at a bit of odds with the meeting that happened this week, which, according to Mayor Sohi's office, is one of the firsts. Basically, all levels of government got together and met with the mayor of Edmonton to talk about this housing and houselessness emergency and what they're going to do about it.
Yeah, they met on February 5th. The four levels of government, this is municipal, provincial, federal, and indigenous. Mayor Sohi said that, as you pointed out, it's the first time that he's aware that they've all come together at the same table to talk about better coordination of existing funding and then trying to identify some gaps. Again, this is a conversation. It's not funding announcement or any kind of action. The promise of this conversation, of course, is that maybe there's some other options here that the four levels of government can bring to the table around coordination, around speeding up the creation of affordable housing. Maybe between the federal government and the city and the Indigenous representatives, they can convince the province to come to the table and support some of the supportive housing. All we've got so far is a meeting and a bit of optimism from the mayor.
For those who were saying during the housing and houselessness debate that, you know, Mayor Sohi was crying wolf and that this was performative and it wasn't going to actually get anything done. His argument was, we've never gotten all orders of government at the table before, and perhaps this could convince them to join the table. And they have. Good play. We'll see, you know, what this yields, if anything. But, you know, if this is the first step towards meaningful action on housing and houselessness and meaningful coordinated action between all levels of government, solid play, Mr. Sohi. That was a big brain move. We'll wait for the chessboard to resolve, but
yeah.
Perhaps was, you know, that I'm going to embarrass myself with chess terminology. What is it called when you do the check? No, I'm not. I'm going to stop. We're not going to talk about chess. We're not. No checkmates. No something mate. There's you move like two pieces and then there's, is it scholar's mate? I think it's scholar's mate, Mac. I think scholar's mate is a thing. Let's.
Is that a thing? I don't know if that's a thing.
Scholar's mate. We're going to Google it. And the scholar's mate is the four-move checkmate. So there we go. I got there, and I impressed every listener with my chess knowledge.
Well done. Well done.
Of course, this wasn't the only discussion around housing and houselessness. This week, Heather Barlow, Jason Nixon's press secretary, told Taproot that the reception center they had established has seen more than 415 people and made more than 1,500 referrals, which does sound pretty good. Unfortunately, when you think about it, it starts to sound less good. And that is what we heard a little bit of.
Yeah, this is some reporting that Tapper did about this. More than 200 people have been connected with health services, 70 with mental health and addiction support. More than 150 people have been referred to housing programs. More than 220 connected to emergency shelter spaces. There's some encouraging numbers, I would say, that the province shared with our reporters about how successful that center has been. But Tappert also spoke with Jim Gurnett, who's spokesperson for the Edmonton Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. He had a different take on this and said those numbers sound good, but just being taken to the reception center doesn't really mean that anything has materially improved in your life. He said, quote, from that experience, what you might have done is leave there an hour later with a few pamphlets in your pocket and still had to find somewhere to sleep that night, which is a good point. The province is saying we've connected and referred people, but it doesn't mean that they were able to follow through and find housing or access to support, just that they, you know, made a connection or got some information. The other thing that was interesting to me about the story in the second half was just looking at, you know, those who do have their encampments removed, where are they going? Are they going to the reception center? Are they going other places? And we heard from Bryce Ward of the Tawa Outreach Collective that they believe the population of displaced homeless people has doubled on the south side of the river in Strathcona. Maybe that it's pushing folks over there because of the encampment clearing that's happening downtown. the Old Strathcona Business Association said it hasn't noticed an increase in social disorder, and that beat officers who patrol the area have seen a decrease in social disorder, which isn't exactly an answer to the question of, are there more encampments there? Like, social disorder encampments for lots of people are the same, but not actually when you think about it. But it's interesting to consider what the implications of encampment clearing downtown might be on other parts of the city.
People always talked about when you clear an encampment, they just move down the street, and that doesn't accomplish anything. Of course, if you're clearing encampments every single day, you know, these are people that are living in encampments, and people have a pretty large capacity for learning. It's one of our evolutionary traits that allowed us to be so successful. If you are clearing encampments of everyone downtown and saying, we're cleaning up downtown, people are going to move. They can get on a bus. They can go anywhere in the city. And with 12,000 kilometers of road in the city of Edmonton.
I also think we should just be careful to recognize the reality that we did before Christmas aggressively clear encampments. I'm not sure that that's been maintained. I went for dinner in Chinatown the other night. Looks to me like the same number of encampments that have always been around the Hope Mission and those facilities over there. I pass the same encampment every day on my way home from dropping my daughter off at school. Like, we might have temporarily cleaned these things up, but as people point out, people don't have a place to go. They're going to come back. I'm not convinced, actually, that we have greatly displaced the population, given the number of encampments that remain in the core and in the downtown area.
I think there's one example in the city of where an encampment that, you know, has been reasonably perpetual has been cleared and has stayed cleared. And that's right on the LRT track multi-use trail between 97th Street and, I want to say, 82nd Street, over by that Save on Foods. And the reason it's been kept clear is because they installed fencing.
Yeah.
The entire area is blocked off. So if that's the lesson that we take away is every public space in Edmonton must be fenced in, I don't know that that's the correct takeaway here. The fencing is sort of accepting the reality that it is not possible to keep that area clear of encampments because it is, you know, an attractive space, reasonably sheltered, close to transit, close to services. It's a good spot, and that's why it's been used. To address the problem by installing fencing around the spot rather than just, you know, making a better spot. I think back to the early aughts when piracy was a problem, and Gabe Newell of Valve fame said, you know, piracy is a service delivery problem, and created Steam. If there is negative behaviors that you're observing, it is far easier to create a better alternative and get people to align behind that better alternative than it is to take punitive action against the people doing the most convenient thing for them. That is exactly what we're seeing here. Sometimes, though, punitive action is warranted, and the feds seem to believe that terrorism-based punitive action is warranted in the City Hall shooting incident. You'll recall that this is an event that happened late in January. No one was hurt or harmed except our beautiful City Hall, which sustained some damage from bullets and a Molotov cocktail. The Edmonton police have now dropped their charges against the individual because the charges have been upgraded to terrorism charges prosecuted by the feds.
That's right. The RCMP have charged the suspect, Bezani Savar, with terrorism offense and possession of property for terrorist purposes. There's a whole suite of criminal charges they've laid against this individual, which they say constitute terrorism offenses. Our Minister of National Defense, Bill Blair, happened to be in Edmonton the other day and commented that the bar for terrorism is pretty high. So this is a pretty serious suite of charges that's been levied here. It's now a federal issue to deal with, and this individual's due back in court on March 15th as the case transitions from provincial to federal jurisdiction. And as for City Hall, repairs continue. It's starting to reopen. There will be an Edmonton Police Service graduation, which usually takes place in the city room, the big room at City Hall, on March 8th, as you're listening to this podcast. But it remains closed to the public. There's some things that will start to reappear, though. So in addition to that graduation, some students attending City Hall School will be there beginning March 11th. And then there's other improvements that are being made. We've seen that metal detectors have been installed, which I found quite curious, Troy, because there's quite a number of entrances and exits to City Hall. I don't know if they're all going to have metal detectors. We'll find out, I suppose, when City Hall reopens fully to the public. There isn't a date for that yet, but the city is working on that.
media has had access to City Hall. Have you been inside since?
I've not gone down in person, no. I've just looked at some of the other media folks reporting and seen the photo of the metal detectors and things.
When I heard that they were installing metal detectors, my same thought was as yours. You know, there's a lot of doors to City Hall. There are basically two possible outcomes here. The first is they install a metal detector on every door, which is expensive and, you know, difficult. The second, more likely option is many of the doors remain locked with a sign saying you can now only enter through this one door, which lowers the accessibility of City Hall. It's a very permeable building, which has been an asset to it, especially in this center area on Churchill Square. Regardless of which option they choose, I can't help but see it as a blueprint for fare gates on the LRT, right? If you can take a very permeable City Hall and install control gates on access to it, why can't you do that on our same very permeable LRT platforms? This is not to say it's a good idea, but the question has to be levied. Why is City Hall different than LRT? Is safety not important on LRT as well? Do we not have safety incidences on LRT? It strikes that perhaps it is a bit of City Hall hypocrisy.
I mean, we already had metal detectors in council chambers. I don't know that we necessarily need metal detectors on every entrance. And I hear what you're saying about the LRT, but presumably that would only apply to the Capital Line, because the Valley Line, metal detector's not going to do a whole lot for you there.
Unless we install walls.
Yeah, or back to the fence conversation or something. But I hope that City Hall remains a more permeable, open, accessible space. But we'll have to see what the city's plans are.
While there have been metal detectors for council meetings, the ones outside the River Valley Room were not permanent metal detectors.
Yeah.
They were movable and, you know, only installed on particular council days or when there was a lot of gumption about a particular meeting. So that is certainly an option as well, that these are things that they scale up with, you know, contentious meetings or as staffing concerns allow.
True. Yep.
Speaking of upcoming contentious meetings, Kate's group has asked for an extension of their parking lot, the gravel parking lot just north of Rogers Place. This was something that was approved back in 2016. And it is now due for a renewal if they are want to continue to operate the parking lot.
Yeah, these lots are between 105th Ave and 106th Avenue, between 101st Street, 103rd Street, so just behind Rogers Place there. They were always intended to be temporary. As you say, they first got permission to run them as parking lots back in 2016. They got an extension. Now they want to extend that again to December 31st, 2028. The last extension was somewhat controversial. This is not in alignment with the city plan or, in fact, any of our stated plans for downtown to have gravel parking lots. One of the great things people like to talk about is how Rogers Place and its development got rid of a whole bunch of gravel parking lots, and yet here we are still operating some. So I'm not sure what council will do here, but it is coming to council at public hearing on Monday, March 11th, and they'll decide or kick the can down the road whether or not to let these temporary parking lots continue.
Of course, the other piece of context within all of this is it has come to bear that Boyle Street's lease was less amicably resolved with the Cates Group. So that may be influencing at least some members of council's opinion. Perhaps they might feel that Cates hasn't given enough back to the community in the area to warrant the goodwill of council approving his money printing gravel lot. Like you said, this is coming up next week at council. But looking back a little bit, the Chinatown Recovery Fund, this was $1 million that had been awarded to Chinatown for recovery-based purposes. We heard some reporting from Taproot this week that most of that actually went to security.
Yeah, the list of successful proposals was finally released, and so we had a chance to look at that and to talk to the city about it. And it just struck us that of the $1 million, more than 700,000 of it went to things related to security rather than things related to vibrancy. The city told us that there were 75 proposals, 16 of which got the green light for funding. The largest of these was $622,000 for more than 120 businesses to upgrade security. There was a bunch of other smaller ones that were related to security. And there was a small number of projects like events and things like that that were funded as part of this as well. So it's called the Recovery Fund, vibrancy is part of it. I think that recovery word, if I'm reading between the lines here, was maybe used to justify this to some degree. Clearly, the folks in Chinatown who put forward these proposals felt like the need right now was security. But it doesn't seem to me to be a very effective recovery strategy. You know, what happens here? Do you turn Chinatown into a prison, essentially? You walk around and you see bars and roll shutters and gates and locks and all kinds of things that don't make it a very friendly place to be, which is, you know, what I remember the sort of spirit of conversation around these recovery funds was all about. How do we change the conversation in Chinatown so that it's not just about the negative street disorder that we see and the implications, the impacts, the effects of houselessness and the opioids addictions and things like that, but how do we make it a vibrant, welcoming place for people who want to come here and visit here? Security doesn't seem like it will achieve that. I understand that for lots of folks, they see that as a prerequisite, however.
Broken windows theory in policing, you know, to what extent does the appearance of disorder cause additional disorder? I can think of Panther Gym. It's on the corner of 96th Street and White Ave. And during the day, you know, it's a gym, right? It's a boxing gym. It's brightly lit, but like it's cool. Like you can see inside and people are having a blast in there. But at close time, there are massive security roll shutters that drop down and completely close it off. And Mac, it feels very unsafe in that area late at night. If we're talking about increasing vibrancy in a space that come 6 p.m., rolls shutter and the criminal elements take over and have free reign like it's the Purge while everyone's locked in behind metal barriers, that does not instill confidence in an area. I'm not saying Chinatown is like that, but that is the impression that I get as a tourist to Edmonton or as someone who's not familiar with the area, just walking by and seeing these roll shutter close. I totally empathize with the businesses who, you know, may have sustained losses and broken windows. I worry that the immediate fix that's being proposed right here will harm the long-term recovery of the area by sort of like codifying with infrastructure the fears that many people have at this given moment in time.
I definitely share that concern. I guess there's a little bit of hope here. William Lau is one of the members of the advisory committee who adjudicated all of the proposals. And he told Taproot that the number of proposals that came in related to security, the committee kind of saw this as a much needed step just to build confidence, right? It was such an overwhelming concern from folks that approving all of this funding for security was just an initial step to build some confidence here. We do understand the city has a vibrancy fund that applications will open for sometime in March. You know, in the coming weeks, they told us that we'll see details on the application process. And that one is a little bit more explicitly about vibrancy. So maybe now that this recovery fund has invested a bunch in security, we can fund some of those proposals that, you know, bring some of that life and color back into Chinatown and make it feel like a more welcoming, friendly place.
You know, Chinatown has for a long time felt ignored by planners at the city. To come in with a fund and ignore all the requests for security and say, now we're going to install some sculptures and have an event, that could have left a very sour taste in many of the community members' mouths.
Indeed.
The last thing we'll talk about today is at this week's utility committee, we finally got the update from EPCOR about the communications exercise that happened around the water ban. This was the one that happened at the end of January, where Edmontonians were asked to curb non-essential water use, and businesses, the high water using businesses, were asked to close or significantly change operations.
First, I just want to share Mayor Sohi's comments. He said that he thought EPCOR tried to manage the situation as effectively as they could and communicated as effectively as they could. He thinks the organization is very well run and they look at risk in a very effective way. He had lots of positive things to say. Of course, we heard from lots of business owners, in particular car wash owners, that this was a huge impact on their business, right? This is like a week without business for those that, you know, adhered to the ban and were not able to operate for those 5 days. Councillor Tim Cartmell felt differently, of course, and said that the communications efforts from EPCOR need to improve dramatically in a statement that he posted online. He said the approach was fair and equitable, but it wasn't clearly communicated or understood by the affected parties. So he feels like EPCOR needs to learn from this and do better, which is not a bad take, I'd say, Troy.
Of course, the risk is, when are they going to do better? this shouldn't happen again. It is the fundamental problem right here. You know, in the postmortem of the event, it wasn't one thing that went wrong.
Right.
It was the confluence of several events that should never happen independently, all happened at once. I'm far more interested in how exactly all those events managed to form this confluence. And I think if we're learning anything from this, it's maybe something about redundancy and operation management and making sure that you've got alerts in place to prevent an issue like this. I feel for the car wash owners, you know, winter is an important time for car washes. They make a lot of money as people have a bunch of salt and calcium chloride on their cars. It sucks to lose that business. But at the end of the day, we're about to face a drought in Alberta. The water wars are coming. I don't know that the takeaway from this event is we need to be better at preserving car wash profits. I'd like to see a better, more robust communication exercise around water restrictions because they're going to happen again. And I don't love that we're framing it around preserving the profits of the most valuable time for car washes.
In his statement, Councillor Carmel talked about these 250 customers with the highest water consumption, right? And said that, you know, maybe the communication efforts to contact them could be improved and that the messaging could have been a little bit clearer. Without having seen the communication, I think he might be right about that. There's probably room for improvement there. He wasn't all critical, though. He also said that it was pretty commendable that EPCOR was able to get the system repaired and working again so quickly. He said, quote, "It is remarkable that the damaged electrical equipment was repaired in a little over a day." So, you know, had some positive things to say about how EPCOR handled a pretty unexpected and complicated issue. As you point out, lots of things went wrong at the same time in order to result in the non-essential water ban. But you're right, it's probably not going to be the last time. So what can we learn from this to do better in the future?
One of the things in Tim Cartmell's statement that I thought was really fascinating and worth highlighting is he mentioned that under normal circumstances, reservoirs are about 80% full at the beginning of the day, but within one day, reservoir levels fall to 40%. This, of course, is why EPCOR issued this restriction, is they didn't want the reservoirs to come empty and to have, I don't know what it's called when you get a water blackout, a dripless system, whatever.
A drought.
Yeah, I guess a drought. They didn't want to get to that point, so they were protecting the reservoir. We talked about this previously when we were talking about the North Saskatchewan River. There's one source of water in Edmonton, and it's our river. And we don't have a lot of redundancy set up. If the river, you know, for some reason became undrinkable for a day or two, we're out of water. We burn through our reservoir in a couple days. That's all we've got. I work in software, disaster recovery and, you know, planning for redundant backups on servers offsite. This is something that I do to make sure everything's operating effectively. And it just strikes me as insane that this entire city, and not even just the city, the entire region has this one single point of failure for the single most important necessity of life. I don't know what's going to happen in the next 20 years, but you know, if drought and water conditions continue to be as much of an issue as they're predicted to be this year, I think this is going to bear quite a bit of improvement. I don't think this is the robust system that we need to last us into, and I'll say it again, the end of the water wars.
And I mean, it'll probably come down to cost, don't you think? Just like all of these other climate change issues, just to build on your example a little bit, it's pretty trivial to spin up another server these days. It's not so trivial to spin up another water treatment plant.
Or indeed another river.
Yeah, those things just don't come online as quickly or as cheaply as the technology does. And so, you know, it'll come down to where do we invest our resources around climate resiliency, and is this one of the places that we need to do that?
Of course, water treatment is one way to clean water. Boiling is another one. And what's the best way to boil water? With fire. Mac, I'm transitioning into the rapid fire segment.
Edmonton-based Flair Airlines has submitted a court filing petitioning to allow it to purchase some of the now defunct Lynx Air's airplanes. Though the budget airline owes over $60 million in outstanding taxes, it assured the court that it was good for the planes, quote, "at least if Justin doesn't try to take the CERB money I claimed back. If they sent it to me, it means I'm eligible."
Ministers Blair and Wassenaar have announced $45.3 million of investment to upgrade facilities at the Edmonton military base in advance of the rollouts of martial law to enforce 15-minute zones.
An Edmonton woman celebrated her 110th birthday recently. Irene Lance was born in Saskatchewan, and after spending some time in Calgary, she moved to Edmonton in the 1950s, where she spent time walking, gardening, making her own yogurt, and waiting for the number 8 bus to arrive on schedule. 74 years later, she's still waiting, but she's optimistic it can still happen.
Speaking Municipally is a publication of Taproot Edmonton. We're going to talk to you once more about the Taproot Edmonton calendar. It's full of events that you might want to see this upcoming weekend or the next week. Mac, The Sound of Music is playing at the Citadel Theater. I don't know if our listeners have got that I'm a huge musical buff, but I will absolutely be heading down over to the Citadel to enjoy The Sound of Music.
Who doesn't love a little music and Sound of Music? That sounds fun. A couple of events that stood out to me, just given kind of what I'm into these days and interested in, of course. I've just finished reading the book Big Mall by Kate Black, local author, about shopping for meaning. That's the subtitle, but it's about her experience growing up with West Edmonton Mall. It's pretty interesting. She's got an event, a book launch at Audrey's Books on March 21st. Before that, there's the Startup TNT Investment Summits coming up on March 14th. They've got 3 this time. Some startups will be pitching for money. That's always interesting. And for those of you who are interested in the arts world, you'll recall that Sanjay Shahani has decided to leave the Edmonton Arts Council, and there's a farewell for him coming up on March 11th at the Art Gallery of Alberta.
You can find all that and so much more at edmonton.taproot.events. And that's all for this week. We'll see you in another one. Until then, I'm Troy.
I'm Mac.
And we're
Speaking Municipally.